It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Our panelists starting at the end.
Hi, so I'm Sean Duke. I'm a member of the Skippy and Fanti Show podcast, which is, I guess, we're like nominated for something. I'm an academic and I work on this Skippy and Fanti Show, and I'm also happen to be one of the editors of SpecFic. I think it's 2014 or 2015. I can't remember what year it's going to be. SpecFic 2012 is also on the ballot this year, so just there's a lineage. So there'll be another one that comes out this year, but then ours comes out next year. So I think that's about enough about me.
Hi, my name's Madeline Ashby. I'm a science fiction writer with Angry Robot Books. I have a series with them called The Machine Dynasty, which is about self-replicating humanoid robots who eat each other. It was really anime-influenced because my first master's is in Japanese animation, cyborg theory, and fan culture. I've written about anime for Tor.com and io9.com. I published academically with Transformative Works and Cultures, and I've written and I blog at MadelineAshby.com occasionally about anime and about a bunch of other stuff. That's kind of where I come from, and that's I suspect why they included me here. And then in my day job, I am a sort of a futurist. I write stories about technologies that are in development for the benefit of the companies that are developing them, so that they kind of understand the human cost of what they're doing, and I start conversations for them on those things. So yeah, that's what I do.
I am JK. I'm a professor at the University of Sorbonne on media, and I review anime and mangas for Le Monde newspaper, and I am sorry if my accent is a bit difficult to understand. I watch a gigantic amount of anime on robots, except for doing robots with Kinects and Legos, I didn't do much professionally about that, so I'm sorry.
I'm David Shaw. I don't write about the stuff, but I watch an awful lot of the stuff. Starting out actually as a kid, when in New York City back in the early 60s, in order to fill up time, they started broadcasting new English translations of old black and white anime, which tended to be either rebranded Astro Boy or what was called in the States Gigantor, known actually to the purists as Tetsujin Nijihachi Go. And that was my introduction to Mecha. So why don't we get started? Where do we want to start? Do we want to do a little historical survey and then move forward?
Why are we doing this?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Why are we doing this?
Why?
Like, what is it about philosophy and Mecha?
Hash out the basics.
Presumably you came because you were interested not just in, you know, not just in anime and not just in giant robots, but in the sort of philosophical or the deeper implications of that idea, right? So
true.
And if not, I'm sorry. But
it'd be an awkward experience.
Dive in.
Personally, for me, I've always been, I sort of got into giant mecha anime probably in high school, which for me began, I graduated high school in 2001. So for me that was things like getting Evangelion from my local video rental store back when those existed, and then watching, I think, demanding that I stay over at my boyfriend's so that I could watch Toonami on cable television, because at that time I lived in America. Now I live in Canada, and watching Gundam Wing and things like that, and getting used to that whole universe. And stuff, and really just liking the idea of there being, you know, how a giant robot works, or how it, you know, how it functions or something like that has never been for me the most interesting part of it. It's the best analogy we have for, short of someone, you know, having a sex bot, it is the best, which is the other thing I write about, it is the best analogy that we have for a relationship with technology. To me, it's always been a really powerful metaphor for understanding how humans use technology in a very intimate and interesting way, in that you are literally sat around and surrounded by this thing that becomes an extension of the self. It's in the philosophy of science, it's actually called the extended phenotype, which is to say that you have a body that expresses from the phenotypes of your genes, but we also have this extension of the self, which is mediated through technology. And so for me, what's interesting about the mecha is it as the armor, not just around the body, but around the self. And so when I think about it that way, my brain just starts to spin. I haven't written a giant robot novel yet, but I really should amend that, and add that to my repertoire. So
Well, I mean, since you already kind of brought up that, I think the first anime I ever watched, knowing I was watching an anime, was Gundam Wing, and it would have been on, I'm pretty sure it was Toonami or something like that. And when I went back to that, when I first watched it, I was basically watching it for the reason everyone was probably watching it who was a teenager. It was just giant robots blowing stuff up for 30 minutes every couple of episodes, right? But when I went back to it, one of the things that I noticed that was really compelling about the show is the deeply political nature of that entire series. You know, because the expectation is it is just that kind of explosions and big robots, but it is deeply political, the complex relationships between political entities. But there's also one of the things that you've already brought up is this idea of what you call as the external phenotype.
Yeah.
And in that show, that particularly becomes quite important, because some of the characters in Gundam Wing become almost obsessed with their relationship with their Gundam, and it becomes sort of an extension of their selves. And so to actually sever it from them, in fact, if I recall, one of the characters basically goes into almost like a comatose state because his Gundam gets destroyed and he can't function anymore because he can no longer be a part of that until it gets rebuilt, and then he gets to, everything's fine again somehow magically. I find that one of the really compelling things about either the Gundam or the mecha itself is the way in which it becomes an extension of the self, but also not just an extension, but a part of that self. And they can't be, in some cases, can't be separated.
Right.
So, yeah.
The first anime I watched was probably Mazinger Z2, and it's kind of obscure now, but it's a really old anime where the robots sometimes have incredible power and can punch people with fire punches and stuff. So it wasn't really philosophical at the time. And then, it's very cliche, but I've watched Gundam Wing too. But I really started thinking about the metaphor in the making Bottoms, which is another kind of forgotten anime now, and Evangelion, which I think for most of you I've watched, this is really great. And I started thinking, what is the director and the writer doing by putting those giant robots? Sometimes it's about a metaphor of the samurai way that they've lost after World War II because they've been demilitarized. There's no military now. And there's such an obsession with the technology of the robots and buttons and the military and how they work and stuff. But sometimes it's about nobility, like Escaflowne, how those are put together and what makes a good pilot and what makes a terrible pilot and what makes an interesting pilot like Shinji can be really annoying for some people watching Evangelion, but he's one of the most compelling, interesting pilots I've seen in the making for a long time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that it's such a tough thing about power identity. Sometimes it's sexual. There's a lot of weird scene in Evangelion about that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think more than anything, because they were fan of old anime like Magic as an adult, and because they were thinking about otaku culture and Japanese culture, they put those thoughts in Giant Robots.
Yeah. Well, with Tetsuji, I mean, it was so primitive. It was this, you know, Klaatu-style giant Gork-style giant robot controlled by a box with two joysticks. We used to joke that Gigantor or Tetsuji would do anything just by wiggling the joysticks backwards and forth. Turn into a battleship, destroy that thing, and Johnny Sparks, who was the nominal controller of the robot, would occasionally lose the box. That was like the MacGuffin for half the episode. Somebody else got the box. And even though I was just a kid, I remember, no, that's not your box. That's his box. That's his robot. It belongs to him. That robot is part of him.
Right.
So even, you know, back then, kids were identifying with the fact that you could have this sort of extension of yourself, even if it was controlled in the most primitive way possible. Mentioning Evangelion, we watched, you know, everyone's seen Pacific Rim, which, of course, is Evangelion with the serial numbers filed off. But the bit about that movie that gets glossed over because of all the other spectacle, and they just kind of toss it out once or twice, that notion that two people have to work a mecha, and two people have to merge their minds. So you're extending yourself not only into this giant mechanism, but into another person. And they play it up as a love interest, but there's something much deeper going on there that winds up being completely unexplored because it's a big movie where things blow up and catch.
But that in itself is also sort of Evangelion taken because the all of the Evas have a ghostly self inside of them of varying degrees of quality and stuff. So and you do end up merging with that person as well, or they might take over and do terrible, terrible things with the machine. When I saw that sort of side of it, that we need two people, and it's like, you took that too.
Yep.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. I think even if we're going to talk about Pacific Rim, which is obviously not an anime, but if you're making these kinds of connections, even something like Evangelion, which I have not seen the ending of in a while, because the last time I watched it, I got really confused.
Which of the many endings are you referring to?
It's one of them, but maybe the second and a half. I don't remember. But I recall him being very confused. But there is a notion here that we're dealing with these selves that are interacting with their mecha, but that to some extent the self is being lost or being extracted. So like in Pacific Rim, I mean, the question is, how much are they actually unique people in the fact that they're interacting with their memories? They're sharing memories, and those memories are no longer unique to you because you're not just sharing them, you're experiencing them.
Yeah.
Or even in Evangelion, getting to the end where Shinji basically, he transcends humanity or self.
Yeah.
It was one possible argument. And where at that point, at what point is there a human self in this particular schema, if there is a human self at the end of that, or if it's absent, gone?
Well, that's a really interesting part of it, is that like a lot of these anime sort of depend on the idea that there is a soul. And that is in dispute. Scientifically, theologically, culturally, that idea of there being a thing inside of you that is you, that lives on, that can be copied by technology, or that lives on after death, or can be sort of put in another box or something like that. Like that idea is a really incredibly, it's an old idea for humans culturally, the Cartesian self, the Cartesian dualism, but it would be interesting for me. I think that's the next frontier, is this idea of, you know, it doesn't matter whether or not there's a human soul to this thing. We just need your biological responses, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, there's the story of compatibility in Evangelion that is the same that in Pacific Rim. You have to be compatible. And you can be really cynical about this and go, well, the robots are their moms. Mm-hmm. Got that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, the soul is really interesting because there are a ton of sins, and you again can be really cynical about this and say Hideaki Anno took all the money to make one action scene, and then I had like zero budget, like hired a voice actor and say something really cool. But they talk to themselves a ton of times, and when they're in each other robots, it happens sometimes in training, they can smell each other, which is kind of weird. They can also sense each other,
mm-hmm.
and you can't exchange the robots.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and when I don't know if a lot of people have seen the reboot movie, but at one point Ezekiel goes into another robot and goes so wrong because of an angel, but really the angels don't matter.
Yeah.
Really, it's because she's going into another robot that's not basically her mom.
Yeah.
But
it rejects her.
Yeah.
No, we're done.
I spoiled everything.
No.
Now, what about the subgenre where it's not just a mecha, where a group of people have to combine to make it?
Mm.
I mean, is that worth considering here? Because it's you know, after doing Evangelion, years later, Gainax produced Tengen, Toppo, Gurren and Lagann.
Right.
It's not a mecha, but you know, you have to combine in order to defeat the bad guys. In that case, it was another huge thing about whether these people were all compatible. But it seems that plot line has become more popular, the group mind rather than the solo mind controlling these objects. What does that say about how we think about these things now?
I think it's a bigger cast. It's a great metaphor for teamwork. For pulling together and it means you have those dynamics of whether or not people can work together and stuff. It's not as much about the self, the insular self. It's about everybody pulling together, like the theme, the end of every anime ever, which is everyone work together to defeat the enemy.
one point. There's also another philosophical that just because someone looks like an enemy to you, they may not be an enemy to themselves, and they may not be an enemy objectively. I'm not going to say anything more than that, but isn't that covered a lot in that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe someone who I'm quizzing people, the anime where they get into a giant robot, but they have to do it or they die. And opening is Alien Star, what is that? That is
Someone said something.
Did they die afterwards?
Yes.
Father Adam.
Yes, and that's one of the things. You don't know who the enemy is, and when at the end they understand what's going on, it's too late. And that's dealing with. Who's the enemy in this? Why do we need giant robots? Sometimes they're really small. The bottoms are just basically tanks. But really cool tanks, not like lame tanks. People like. But in Evangelion, Shinji keep asking, what are these things going on?
Why do I need to do this?
And they're really monsters, which is not the case in most anime, where it's just sort of big monster things. They're really scary. And that's a continuous theme.
Yeah, no, I like the... I really like... It's probably the closest I've ever been to being a Lovecraft fan, which is hard, because I live... My fiancé is a horror writer who loves Lovecraft, and to me it's just like, well, that's great that you know, this turgidly written racist fiction is so popular among that crowd. That's nice for you. But that those crazy monsters, those like that's straight out of Lovecraft. That's straight out of horror fiction. Is these things from beyond the depths of time and space? There are these angels that come and are awful and can break your mind just by looking at them, et cetera, et cetera. That's a total Lovecraftian trope,
which is what they do in Pacific Rim and Out of the Rim.
Yes,
Cthulhu attacks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's Cthulhu versus a big robot, which is like.
The best.
Why didn't anybody pitch that years ago?
And when you have the time over, you know, 26, 28 episodes, the enemy becomes more and more and more monstrous and horrible. You know, it's like leveling up
in RPG.
That one is easy. These are going to be great. We're going to destroy them all. Oh, wait, what's that one?
But the final one looks like us.
Yes.
Which I always loved. It went through this progressive level of monstrousness and horrible, almost Lovecraftian unrecognizability, and then finally just gave you a very beautiful boy.
Yeah.
One of the very first one is like a centipede-like creature, and it's just a big thing. But then there's the virus.
That
is not defeated at all by the robots. And yes, there's Carolyn.
Yeah.
So really, they're getting more cerebral and more human as time goes by. And the one who... I'm spoiling everything again.
It's been since 1995, yes. I think.
Good. the one who completely beats Azika to a state where she's basically comatose is the one that sees her soul.
Yeah, into
and
the mind.
As you can tell her, your mom is the robot, but she hates you, and has to come deal with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we should also think about the opposite of this, because it's not just the most monstrous in this question of the enemy, but I mean, even something like Gundam Wing, or even some other shows, where it's the actual human characters who become increasingly monstrous over time.
As time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, Gundam Wing is my... I just love Gundam Wing.
Yeah,
so,
no. I still go back to it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean,
it's terribly animated. It's such shit.
It is, but it's got to be... But, I mean,
it's so terrible.
Throughout that series, I mean, the increasing interactions between... on the one hand, the Gundams themselves are doing all of these acts, and some of them actually become morally... They basically break down, the morality breaks down, because they don't know how to actually justify the horrible things that they have done in the service of their own agenda. But on the opposite side of that, in reaction to them, we get these increasingly more violent reactions where entire space stations are being destroyed by the Earth forces as a retaliation. And so when you get towards the end of this series, the enemies may seem like they're clear, but they really shouldn't be. It shouldn't be like our Gundam pilots are not necessarily the good guys, but neither are the opposite side, because they're both doing quite horrendous things in the service of their own agendas.
What I really like about that show is that it's essentially, it's very bold. Like, I think the only Homeland is one, and Zankin no Terror is the other, that are basically, it's a show about a group of terrorists.
Sure.
Like, it's told from their perspective. And you understand their point and like where they're lining up,
right,
and like all
the
of those
scrappy
things.
Band.
It's pitched to you as this like it's this scrappy band of very beautiful teenage boys who are going to undermine the government and whatever. But it's a show about terrorism, and it's told from the perspective of the terrorists.
Yes, and
stuff. And it's very rare to get a story like that that's about these guys who are just trying to undermine the government in such a violent way.
Yeah, and in Gurren Lagann, they are literally traveling across a desert before they get to their big confrontation at the end.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Kagis, because the problem with it, well, it's not a problem, but with the terrorist thing, is that the main character is an aristocrat, and he comes from the Britannia. Spoiling everything, he comes from the Britannia family, so he's not the underdog. Weirdly, the underdog, and he's the most hated character of the series, is Suzuku.
This was kind of why I could never get into it, yeah.
Does anyone like this guy? And is the one who's supposed to be the guy who's fighting against... with a robot against the horrible slavish governance, but he's working with them, with another robot, the lesser one.
I said someone was going to ask. I said we're going to take questions at the end.
I was like, is it that time?
No. We're just getting warmed up here. They say that every episode of The Outer Limits is actually a metaphor for the Cold War. Is every giant mecha story just another Japanese post-apocalyptic atom bomb narrative?
No.
I would say they're all about Article 9.
For example.
Yeah.
Escaflowne has nothing to do with the atom bomb. It's historical fantasy.
Yeah.
Evangeline, of course, is the main example of, you know, the atom bomb, and we're in 2015 and... We're constructing giant robots to handle. Mazinger Zeto is—it's more about atomic power. It's about having power. It's not really about post-apocalyptic thing. It is a lot about that, but there's a lot about we have now giant robots. You have everything else, but we've got the giant robots thing.
Yeah, and I would say that, I mean, some of them certainly are, to some extent, about that, in the same way that Godzilla is, at least the original Godzilla is essentially about that. But there are obviously mecha shows that don't involve the sort of monstrosities coming out of the sea and attacking, or space, as sometimes is the case. Mm. So like the Gasaraki, it does take place in the power vacuum that arises after World War II. But one of the things that Gasaraki does is it's about this ancient family that in the past had created basically like a demon suit thing and is now trying to bring that suit back in order to sort of carve itself out a piece of the power in a vacuum between that's created by the United States, which goes to war with, I believe it's like an imaginary Middle Eastern country, which is very, very poignant. And so they go to war, and then there's some sort of a battle in which these strange suits show up, and they're these mecha suits, and they defeat the enemy, and then all of a sudden this family's like, we're going to carve out a piece of that power for ourselves. Right. So it's certainly about, to some extent, the results of post-World War II Japan, but is not explicitly about, say, atomic power. I had another example, but I've totally forgotten the other example. Pat Labor.
Yes.
Yeah, which is another where the monstrosity is reduced, but I would say the Palabore is maybe more about maybe questions about state power.
And identity.
Yeah,
and
identity.
And morale, and why are we doing this? And,
And
even sometimes there are stories where you wonder why a giant mecha is even in the story, which is it's obviously a toyetic property, which is to say it's just there to sell toys, which is the story of the Big O. Which is like, there's this great noir story about am I a replicant or not? It's basically a long-running animated Blade Runner fan fiction. And then there's a giant mecha in it for reasons that are impossible to understand.
I'm glad you said that, because my wife has been watching Big O, and I kind of wander back and forth, and it's like, what's the robot?
What is the robot doing here? Why is it even here? Especially because the protagonist, or the alleged protagonist of that show, Roger Smith, is so cool on his own. Like, he doesn't need a giant robot to self-actualize. He's a self-actualized guy. He's already, pretty happy being himself, seemingly, with his cool car and his great house and his butler and, all that.
How big it does... It does sell. It's like the mascot thing. Sold really well.
Well, it was a cool design.
It's a cool design. And it says, here's a robot, look! And, it's actually in Wall Street. We tricked you.
we're gonna rope him in with the giant... It's such a neat idea, this giant Art Deco robot. I mean, we've seen a lot of giant robot designs. This is a giant Art Deco robot that fights other Art Deco robots. It's like, as a design thing, if you're at all a design nerd, it's just a giant, it's so cool. And then you start to think about it, it's like, why is this even here? Like, why would you even build these?
That's someone going through a Tiffany portfolio and saying, you know what this needs?
Robots. More robots. More robots, please, in this... Brass and blown glass robots.
About post-apocalyptic Japan, I think another theme that you already said, Daisato, for example, it made Ghost in the Shell, Kira
Kasen, and stuff.
And Cowboy Bebop. Of course.
Yeah.
Which we can't really drag. As hard as we try, we can't drag
it. It's the one thing that didn't show up.
Trying
really hard.
But that's Ghost in the Shell, especially about technology.
Oh, yeah.
And Eureka 7 is about a ton of things.
I love Eureka 7.
There's also the theme of racism, really. Cardigans is one big example, but that's about how Americans ruined everything, but we're taking the British to blame them. Technology, and there are some examples of that in where they merge with the robots. And in Evangelion, in the reboot, there's this new character called Mari.
Yeah.
And she becomes a beast with the Evangelion thing. And it's done on purpose, and she's basically becoming the robot. We don't know much about her. The fourth movie hasn't come out. I don't understand anything in the third movie. It's usual of Evangelion. I think it's the most confusing to make anime, maybe anime that people watch.
Well, I think that's their sales strategy, is that if they just keep giving us conflicting information, we'll have to keep buying so that we'll eventually understand what was going on. It's a really... Mm-hmm.
And the way they're numbering them, you know, 1.1, 1.2, it's like software revisions.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Here's the patch.
We'll never be finished, and you'll just keep buying, so everything's great for us.
Well, in Hideaki Anno was finished when he did the TV show.
Yeah.
And he went, well, I've said everything I had to say, and like 2,000 other people went to his room and were like, what are you doing? What is that? What are the anvils?
Yeah.
And he went, oh, you want another movie? A clearer one? Well, I'm making this movie. And it was so confusing, and everyone get more upset the more movies come in. And that's the most interesting one, because they don't... can anyone understand what's really happening in Evangelion? But they don't understand that it's not about the angel and the John Romero.
Yeah, no, that it was never. Yeah, it was never about the plot. Why do you care? He was the original J.J. Abrams. That dude. He is the original J.J. Abrams. Like, people got burned by Lost. I was burned by Evangelion years before. And
I mean,
stuff,
all of that T-shirt that says that I was burned by.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just had a fun anecdote about the director. He used to, he may still go to a convention called FanimeCon in San Jose. And I recall when I went to one of his panels where it was just him, he was talking about some samurai show he was going to do. And he stood up and he said, don't ask me any questions about Evangelion because I'm not going to answer them because I don't know what it means either.
Oh, nice.
So, I don't know how serious he was, but it was really amusing, and it shut people up because they didn't ask him any questions. So
he's very serious about how much he hates Evangelion and the people who watch it. And there's one very pretentious Frenchman at one of the conventions was, oh, what are the biblical references in Evangelion? He said, oh, I found Bible in the anime studio, and I took the names. He was so, like, proud about Evangelion. Like, no. There are no biblical references in Evangelion.
No intentional.
Excellent. We're kind of glossing over or ignoring the fact for the moment that most of these mecha are controlled by teenagers.
Yes.
So, I mean, are all of these giant mecha stories also coming-of-age stories?
I think so.
Yeah.
Are they all learning the same thing?
Well, to me, all genre stories, fantasy stories or SF stories or comic book stories or who knows what, are always about power. Whether or not you have a magical ability or you have a special robot that lets you do things or you become a mad scientist and you change yourself or something like that, it's always about, you know, power and the responsibility of using that power. With great power comes great responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. And most mecha stories are about that. It's like, by jumping in this craft and using it for violence, because you notice that they never use them to, like, build anything. You know how that's weird? That's kind of weird to me. It's like, you know, well, we've destroyed Tokyo 3, and that's really great for the contractors, but wouldn't it be great if we had a giant robot that could lift all of this rebar and put it into place in the space of about 5 minutes? Oh, no, we have to hire humans for that. You know, like, that makes no sense at all. And so what's interesting about it is the idea, and I think that's why it's commonly a coming-of-age story, is that it's about having all of this power and all of this responsibility and how you use it and what that says about you. What your decisions in this device are always going to be sort of watched over and analyzed later, and who you are is how you pilot, and so that's how I always look at it.
I want to point out that it's coming of age story, mostly for boys, because it's considered in Japanese a boy fantasy, and the counterpart for that now. But before it was magical girls got superpower, and boys get makeup.
Yeah.
So I think we have to point at that, because they really want, like, the bigger robots. And often the teenagers, well, not always, in those mechanisms are quite not that strong physically, but they're strong-willed. And that's what's important, that you can surprise yourself and you can become great just with your mind and your intelligence and your strategy. And a lot of new mecha anime fans are military fans, and they want to you know, be in an army and be the great leader, be Nobunaga or all those historical figures that are now in the past because it's been there, and so it's like, I will not, can't say, because there's no military. And that's the point, and that's the coming of age. And when you're an adult, you surpass that, so you work in technology thing, or you are a dad, you say, Shinji, get in the robot!
Yeah, I always found it really curious that it was always teenagers, because logistically it makes no sense why you would give these extremely expensive, very dangerous pieces of equipment to very ill-equipped, emotionally unstable young people, because they almost always are. They have fights over the most absurd things. You know, like you yelled at me at the locker that day, and then they were going to fight over it for like a month. And it plays into how they pilot, and it doesn't make sense logistically, but I think it goes back to the thing you were saying at the very beginning, where how this works doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's almost always about the characters, and I think one of the interesting things about the fact that these are almost always feature teenagers or young people is that it never forgets that there's all of that individual coming-of-age drama, and that uses the mecha as a way of staging all of that. Because we're not in a high school, which is sort of mundane. We're now in these sort of a very violent, horrible situations. But at the same time, they're having to go through, you know, puberty and growing up and sort of, like, love interests and getting bullied and all these kinds of things. But they're doing it in the context of a violent sort of upheaval in their lives. So in some sense, the mecha just becomes sort of an extension of the coming-of-age experience themselves. At least that's how I would see it.
Yeah, there's always this sort of I don't want to. There's always that I don't want to aspect to it, and that the counter argument is, but the world requires it of you.
Yeah, which is the best metaphor for going to work every day.
Yeah, exactly. and in there are some examples of that. There's another message. I mean, in Gurren Lagann, the brotherhood message is you just get beaten over the head with it. You know, family, which is great. Family. Your brother comes first.
Sure.
But I don't want to. I hate him. He's always made me feel bad. So there's always that kind of family dynamic that's being worked out as well, which kind of leads to the next question, which is, why are so many of these robot operators orphans?
But all heroes are orphans.
Well, orphans are so distant from their parents that they may as well be orphans. All heroes are orphans, but why is it always, why are they ideally suited to be these? I mean, if you want to be even more emotionally unstable than just a teenager, how about an orphan teenager? You know, why do we put orphans into robots? What are we trying to tell people when we do that?
Or if not orphans, then estranged, like teenagers who are estranged from their families.
You know, dad's actually the head of the entire research division, but you know, he may as well be a statue as far as kind of.
But I live in my own apartment at 15.
Yeah, exactly.
All heroes are orphans, and B, I guess it plays into that trope of even James Bond was like this. Right, that James Bond was drafted by Her Majesty's Secret Service into when he was a teenager, because his parents were dead, and stuff. So they, I guess, there's that idea that they can grab you and do whatever to you, and you don't have any. Apparently, you have no legal representation because no one is ever like Shinji's guardian, or there was a guardian, but there's no one who's like his lawyer or his legal liaison. There's no one. What would be interesting, what I would like is to see the giant mecha story about, like, kids from the foster care system who were rescued from foster care or from juvie or something like that, and then told, because that seems more likely to me.
When you're an adult and you're piloting a robot, you're doing your job, and that's boring. That's what happens in Padlet Ball. So it's just like, oh, I'm a cop. This is the worst job ever. And she's wearing a giant robot. And in Card Games, also the generals are like, oh, these kids with these robots, I really would like to just not have this war. And they're really bored by it, and you really don't. There's only one or two character adults who are really interested in piloting their robots, but they're all like,
and they're crazy.
Yeah, they're all either psychopaths, so they're like, you can find the giant robots on this point on the bridges, or they like, oh, I'm so bored by these giant robots.
No, it's,
and,
yeah. If you're an adult, if you're an adult and you're into giant robots, your Zeks wear keys, and you're out of your mind.
He is crazy.
Yeah,
it's just that's why he wears the mask.
Yeah, yeah, you're the Phantom of the Gundam.
Yeah, that's exactly. What it is.
And obviously, there's this huge kind of revenge element to all these stories. You know, we're operating these giant robots to get back at this horrible wrong that had been visited upon us. But again, going back to the teenage bit, isn't it the teenage revenge fantasy? Okay, you're my parent. You're going to put me in this thing. I'm going to go out. I'm just going to bust shit up.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I think that's part of the being an orphan there is that you suddenly, and I think that's why the machine takes on that. You're sitting in a womb, right? It's orphans who get to return to this mechanized womb and walk it around and be protected by it forever in this big mechanical shell that they're suddenly able to take on and be stronger than they ever were as a replacement for that relationship sometimes. And part of that is like, now I have that, I can do whatever I want. You know, that's fun times for them and no one else.
Should we take questions? It's about 45 after.
Is it? What time? Yeah.
Yes.
How late are you going?
Yeah, well, we go for an hour and 15. But
Do we go an hour and 15? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
We can certainly start with some questions because
I just wasn't sure.
That can send us off another tangent.
It seems like that's
sweet.
It's that
you actually
time.
Wanted to ask earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How would you like distinguish between the stuff that like Japanese person calls Japan produces masses of genre TV?
Mm.
Like way probably the most genre TV in the world comes out of Japan.
Yeah.
I would think. But I don't know that, I can't prove it. But yeah. How much do you reckon that it's actually philosophy, and how much would you say it's like playing with like the trope, you know, like the tropes of their own stuff? Because I mean, Evangelion has always struck me as a bit sort of Watchmen-like. It's like, you know, it's actually, this is like the old, like, you know, the stuff that you watched, or maybe I watched when I was younger, like or Amazing Z or whatever, is actually like, you know, it's stuff that is being played with by Evangelion, or like Code Geass seems almost like to be playing with the idea of like almost Japaneseness and like what Japanese people think of themselves. You know, like that's why the Japanese character in it is kind of this hateful person, but they also get the thing that normal mech heroes get. You know, they get the sort of amazing robot, and whereas the good guys are almost using the sort of the stuff that you usually associate with a villain. Could you respond to that? Sorry, that was a very.
Well, it's kind of hard at this point. You know, there's been the Japanese content machine has been through so many iterations at this point that they are almost have no choice but to feed you meta commentary about what's come before. You can watch something like Evangelion naively, having seen nothing and knowing nothing of the history of the genre, or you can watch it with all of that history, you know, informing your decisions, and you have two completely different experiences. So it's kind of hard to say, you know, what the intent is whenever one of these things is served up as new. I have a 15-year-old who would, you know, love to be able to live in a giant robot.
Yeah.
But the other thing that, you know, you were talking about magical girls, giant robots. Sailor Moon has just been rebooted, and he is just over the moon, forgive the pun there, over the moon about it, because, you know, now he gets to experience a magical girl story with no history of it before. He just knows that these things exist. So it really does come down to your own cultural background and your own knowledge of the form when you watch these things.
So are you going to... Wait a second. Did he watch... He's going to go through Sailor Moon Crystal... And then are you two together going to watch Madoka?
Yeah.
That's probably a good idea.
You can, I think you can watch Summonings without any knowledge and just enjoy the thing and never think about it again. Gao Geiger is one of the examples. It's just a really, really... watch Gao Geiger. It's just a really, really great mecha story. It's Evangelion. I watch Evangelion with like zero knowledge of anything, but when you rewatch it, you say, "Oh, it's about Otakus." And when you listen to all the interviews about Hideo Kiano, and you recognize the Kudere character of Ray, the Tsundere of Azuka, and how much they influence everything in the characterization, I think it gives a lot of depth. If you don't watch anything and you only think about this, you do really think about the biblical references and you go, oh, there's like the longinus thingy and the angels that I didn't really understand, and you try to understand the ending with that perspective and it often fails. But if you go on meta level and say, what is trying to say to the people at the end, I think it gets easier, at least on one way. There's that. There's military. There's I hate the covenant. There's mom metaphors and dad metaphors. So it went in many ways, but it went philosophical much quicker than Magical Girls anime.
Absolutely.
If you watch Kamen Rider, this is a maker, but it's basically Madoka, and that's much older. And Madoka is really recent. When was
it? Last year.
Yeah, like 2012, maybe, something like that. 2012,
yeah.
And, they really took their time for it, but making an because of the impact. I'm not sure it's like a French term or not, but people say there are, in Mecha Anime's impact of Japanimation, and they say the last one is actually The Melancholy of Haruhi Suzumiya, which is not a Mecha Anime, but they say it had the same impact, and the third one is supposed to be Evangelion.
There's Ganda,
and Mazinger Zeta, and, you know, there's this thing that completely changed how we write anime every time.
No, it's a game changer.
One from this side, you with the Transformers shirt.
I'm just wondering. I mean, because you've spoken about like the classics of the genre, but I'm like trying to look at the creation that you've taken the trope, but then did something different with it. Like, you know, for example, probably mispronouncing it, but they like Escaflowne, where they're taking it to a fantasy setting, or Attack on Titan, where it's really quite a logical mecha.
The mecha is the enemy and they're biological.
Or even Transformers, where it's really about the robot with no drivers at all, if you think about it like that. So, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, classics aside, which ones do you think are doing something different with the trope, like taking it to a different direction or combining it?
I would start with one of the ones that is mentioned in the panel description, which I think is my fault, which is Gasaraki. If you've not seen that, it is not a traditional mecha. I mean, in fact, the mechas are very light in terms of the actual narrative. And one of the things that it does is it essentially like uses almost like a demonic possession narrative. And there's this whole ritual where, there's like a ritual, and he has to wear these very traditional garbs and perform this ceremony before he will be officially like transcended to the stage at which he can use the mecha for the purposes of this family to sort of bring it back to power, which is very different from, you know, you're fighting things that come out of the sea or space. These are just sort of giant monsters. I think that's one that does a very unique thing. It's also a little bit confusing, but probably not at the same level as Evangelion. But you should watch that one. I would recommend that.
I'm probably weird in thinking of Fullmetal Alchemist as a mecha anime.
I thought about that too.
Because it is about a boy's soul piloting an empty suit of armor. And he's essentially in the same position. He's a pilot. He's quite literally the ghost in the machine, or the ghost in the shell. He is that. In that his soul is bonded to the armor, and he has, you know, or Alphonse has to, the little brother has to pilot around that machine and learn how to work it. And there's all the same thing, all the same little moments that happen in a giant robot story about like, oh no, I got it wet, or I got sand in it, or it's damaged, or whatever. All of that happens to him as this sort of guy who walks around this big clunky thing that has now become his body. Instead of it being a story about how do I use this new body, which is I think also why most pilots are teenagers, is because it's really easy to tell a story about teenagers who are trying to learn to use their new bodies because they are getting new bodies as they grow. This is a story about that's his only option. It's not like he can get out of it and have something else. It's, you know, this is it, kid. This is what we have for you until something else happens And the quest to, instead of learning how to pilot it the best, it's the quest of trying to find, to get the organic body back.
With Ghosts in the Shell, you know, it's sort of a mecha story, but it's interesting because the responsible adult is the least mechanized part of the entire collection, and that the actual mecha devices are children.
Yeah,
They're constantly being reined in by the adults to do the right thing.
Yeah, when in fact they're really good at doing the right thing on their own, and like we should really have just gone out of their way.
If you watch the second series, the whole little series of the interstitials of them interacting together and coming up with laws and behaviors and their own philosophy, right?
I think it depends on what you watch. If you watch only military thing, maybe you want to watch Boku Rhino because it's about the enemy. If you watch maybe only Evangelion, like really weird making and maybe Flag, which is on the summary, and it's a collection of found footage. But really, like, now they're nearly always like, we need to do something different than the very classic. Gurren Lagann was very classic in a way, and I think people like that a lot.
But they injected a lot of humor into it, which is really usually absent from this genre. You've been waiting a while there.
We've been talking a lot about like giant robot stories where, you know, it's all about power and responsibility and sometimes and new bodies or new identities and sometimes how the body can take over. I was just thinking how the closest Western analog we have appears in a lot of superhero narratives.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we talked about Big O and how Roger randomly has a giant robot. He has a giant robot because he doesn't dress up as a bat.
Yeah.
We're talking about Peter Parker in Spider-Man, for example, he doesn't want to be a superhero. It's like the world says, well, you have to, and he goes, no, and his uncle gets shot, and he realizes that, yes, I have to be a superhero, or as he learns his powers, we get the Venom storyline, where his powers start to take over, or the, or he gets weird later on with the spider mutation arc, but basically, kind of like super robots as superheroes. It's like it's your costume and you put it on and you become a hero or someone who's not you but has all this, you know, responsibility and ability to do good.
But that's more of an alter ego exploration than an extension of your body. I mean, it's just superheroes is more like looking at another part of your own self when you're given sort of unlimited license to act any way you choose.
Yeah, I think of the mecha as more of a, like, learning how to use a weapon, right? The responsibility that comes with weapons ownership, and how it is that we decide to use, because weapons are power too, right? Like, they're an extension of your will, and they are a technology. That's the thing that they have in common, is that they are literally a tool of the hand that you can use to kill other people. And I think that they often become stories about the responsibility that comes with the ability to kill. And that's, I think, the crossover with the superhero stories. Like, suddenly this, like, I have all these powers that I have this ability that other people don't have, and how do I use that? And what does that say about me?
Kind of reoccurring in the X-Men.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes sometimes that does map over onto the giant mecha genre, because there's always this, not everyone can pilot, or he pilots better than anybody else in his first try, or what have you. And
Gun Parade marches in some aspect of that second part. Yeah. But
and the coming of age story is part of the X-Men, because it was especially insisted on in the first movie that when you're a teenager, you get this power. It transforms your body, and you don't know what to do with it.
You had your hand up. Yes.
Two things. First, thank you for mentioning Armored Trooper Bo Thomas. I'm always one of the few who remember that one. I wanted to ask sort of about another philosophical underpinning, which especially in I saw in one of the early Gundam-style animes in the early Gundam series about dealing with the corruption of and the problems created by the parents' generation or the previous generation. The first two Gundam series almost exclusively dealt with people literally having to pick up the weapons and problems created by the parents and try to find a better resolution from that. So I was wondering what the panel saw as that.
Yeah, Gundam Wing has that element too. I don't know which one that is in the series of Gundams, but the basic premise for those that are not familiar with it is there was at some point a war, and there are now these two separate. There's the Earth, and then there are the people who live on the space stations. And the Gundams come from the space stations to basically exact some form of revenge. And then the crap hits the fan, as it were. But it's all a result of this split that has occurred from a previous generation. We're now dealing with, well, there are, of course, that previous generation still exists, but then there's all the young people who are having to, like, pick up the pieces of all of the political conflict that has resulted from that. And I think it's one of the more fascinating elements of that is it's not a unique conflict. It's something that has existed prior to this that they're now having to deal with in that moment. But maybe others have different...
You know, we should talk about that for a second. We've been talking about, you know, being the robot and fighting the enemy. But the enemy in all of these series is of, you know, a very particular type. It's this, you know, huge unnatural force of nature that you can't control. It's some vast being that you can't understand. You know, why is the enemy always kind of cast in that fashion in these stories?
Well, in the Gundam stories, it's not. It's the humanity is
It's a nation.
Yeah, a nation is usually the one that's it. But you're right that a lot of it is, of course, that sort of the monstrosity, these otherworldly things. But then in the Gundam sequences, it's very much about individual groupings of people are screwing it up for everybody else.
That's very interesting because it's a trope that is constant, and the last anime we did that and it's still on air is Aldinis Zero. And basically it's a part of humanity who has now been living on Mars, I think, and they've come back with giant robots and they're killing everyone. But there was much bitterness from a new generation, especially anime people, actually, so that's very interesting, that, like, you ruined everything by your hubris and your wish to go to war, and we don't want that, but we want the military power yet, so we're going to return that on its head, and all the adults will be really terrible and power-hungry, and we're going to use those things for good. Or not, maybe sometimes you think about it, why are we doing this? But it's not portrayed in a good way when it's problematic.
You've been doing a lot of it, yeah.
Okay, first, Around Red is one that's gotten a bit missed. I mean, that has the element of combining and team and learning to overcome some serious differences, because you have the one society that's entirely male, the other society is entirely female. That's gives combining a whole new meaning. The other thing was something that's been said, we're talking about the extension of extended phenotype and samurais, and wasn't the whole idea that the sword was the soul of the samurai? So a sword was an extension of yourself.
There's a really interesting exhibition going around the world right now called Evangelion and Samurai Swords, and it's a team of incredible katana makers who have remade the robots into samurai swords, and that's their point, is that the robots are basically samurai swords. They have their own swords and their own honors, and you can't, well, they're yours, and that's a really good point, that it's basically an extension, but the samurai is dead except in historical learning.
I was going to say that I think it's Go Nagai, who wrote Gegege, basically had he was raised by his grandparents, and his grandmother would constantly tell him that any object that has been used by the same person or by the same family for over 100 years attains its own soul. And we know that as the story of the Velveteen Rabbit, where if you love something enough, it becomes real and stuff. And so I think that inevitably there's this anthropomorphism of our objects, the objects that we deal with every day that we have a relationship to and stuff. So there's this idea that, you know, a weapon that I carry every day or a piece of armor that I put on every day inevitably sort of becomes this thing that can go, that can do something else, and is imbued with its own value and its own character, and so I think that it's a completely natural place for the art, for the gesture of the art to go.
It's no coincidence that, you know, there's like this weapons development sequence you see in these things, and the first weapon is always just the arm turns into a big blade.
I just had the best little thought from that, and it's gone completely
wrong. Well,
we have a ton of other questions.
All the way in the
back. I'm trying to ask two questions. One to the town, one to the old ones. As someone who's already part machine, and biological systems are gradually deteriorating, I have been watching the real life development of our exoskeleton.
Right.
With a huge amount of interest. And some of the ones that come on aren't that more expensive even now than a very high-end wheelchair. I'd just like to ask the audience for a show of hands, disabled or able-bodied, please put up your hand. If you had the money, would you, and it was available with a compact power source, would you buy a powered suit?
For yourself. No, exactly.
My second question is about the point that you raised right at the beginning. But have you considered the fact that this externalization may be something that's far older than we've previously been thinking of? Speaking of pre-Abrahamic religions, pre-monotheistic religions that we see in the indigenous tribes in Africa, and Southeast Asia, and in South America, where they have many local gods instead of one big, all-powerful one, and the local gods, or the personal gods, can actually be powerful, but far more local and interacting with them. And they have this connection individually to the people. If a certain person does a certain set of effects, they will control this god, this all-powerful, super-powerful being that will wreck the countryside, bring disease to their enemies, make the rains come. Do you think that in some ways the giant robot is just a new gloss on a very, very old story?
Well, there's some parallels. In a lot of the South Pacific Islands, you see that they have these, I guess you'd call them puppets, these giant human representations that you control with bamboo rods or whatever. They walk around with things attached to their knees and elbows that kind of extend this larger version of the person. I don't know that you can make a direct association. I mean, in the context of this panel, we can probably shoehorn that in that way, but I'm not sure that there is a huge religious connection between.
That's the intention, yes. Some of the robots are considered as gods by some characters, or at least supernatural beings that are much higher than humans. But it's not really religion, but the Sun Wukong series, that it's Hanuman, the God, the monkey.
West.
Yes, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't. It's basically like a real. Well, if you've seen Dragon Ball Z, you probably recognize the super monkey, and he's trying to get his priest, to a specific temple to deliver a specific, basically books. And the design cultures would basically make it, and they're an army of giants. Have you seen like the soldiers, the stone soldiers in the Wall of China? Well, they're basically that.
Mm.
And yeah, they're revered as gods, and they have godlike power, and of course being Sun Wukong who destroys them completely. But that's there's all you know, we see robots as the new thing and technology and cross World War II. There are some connection that I don't think they're trying to do. Maybe Esther Flynn was trying to do that very medieval thing, but considering Oriental religion or tradition, there hasn't been that many. There have been some robot samurai.
Mm. Mm.
But, like, consciously doing the god religion thing with the robots, I'm not sure. Maybe someone has an example of that, because we haven't seen it.
Yeah,
I mean, I would tend to think of a lot of the mecha anime to be doing the opposite. It's actually humanity's faced with what seem to be insurmountable odds by supernatural or the appearance of supernatural beings, and then must, of course, create the technology to combat that. So it seems to me the larger technological concern, which sometimes appears in a lot of science fiction, of creating technology to sort of basically take power away from the metaphorical gods. That's not all mecha. I mean, there are some mecha where it actually seems to be going the opposite way. I think Gasaraki does the opposite direction, where it seems you're trying to get closer to some sort of, if not god, then some sort of supernatural presence or thing. In that case, it's more demonic.
I think sometimes you do run into a trope where the pilot is seeking to be worthy of piloting the mecha. And that is a transactional relationship where the pilot does, you know, if they have made a mistake or if they've done something or they're not feeling the mojo or whatever, they kind of are no longer worthy, or the
Asuka.
In Asuka, yeah, like Asuka has those moments. Roger Smith has a moment like that. I think it happens in Gundam Wing a bunch. It actually happens in Eureka 7 a ton of times, you get in the cockpit and the thing just won't turn on, and it's because it is judging you. You are being judged by this piece of technology that is beyond your comprehension. Because it's just so much grander and larger than you, and there's so much more going on with it, and it's especially when it's like an Escaflowne or like one of the machines in Eureka 7, where it's been unearthed from you know, deep in the strata of the world. You know, you have those moments where it's like, this is actually secretly, it's an ancient technology, and it's imbued with enough character that it can sit in judgment of you. And and decide whether or not it wants you to pilot it. And that's kind of, again, like an old metaphor for, you know, owning a horse. You know, right. Sometimes they don't let you ride them.
And these robots are often in some, like, sacred chamber.
Yeah,
you have to figure out
how to open them.
Before you can enter the robot.
Yeah, you have to do some special Indiana Jones work in order to get this thing to work for you and stuff, and then you will have passed the test.
Yes.
There's been this lady, like stand up way at the back.
There, yeah.
Yeah.
You were talking about Gundam in terms of colonization and the Americas, and when you were saying you could use some examples that put you in the framework of the terrorist group, I was thinking maybe of shows like Firefly, Farscape, and Blake. So
yeah, that's true. Yes, yeah, you're right.
I was wondering if we were going to talk about those sort of as separate, as examples of things working similarly, like how might you feel they work in comparison?
Well, I think, for me at least, I think Firefly is a story about people who lost and who are occasionally getting, and Farscape is too, because they're basically the same story, and then we could get into Firefly versus Cowboy Bebop, and then you'll all hate me. Because I'm on the Cowboy Bebop side of things. For me, Firefly is a story about a group of people who were part, who believed in an armed, who believed in a conscripted national army, and then lost, and then slowly took their revenge, but not as part of an organized movement, just because the opportunity was there. Whereas I think the difference between that and the story like either Gundam Wing or Homeland is that these people believe something fundamentally different and are part of an organized effort that they might not see the entire scope of, but they understand that they are part of a larger resistance movement that has definite political goals, which is not necessarily, or at least not in my recollection, not necessarily the case in a story like Firefly, because those people are like, we aim to misbehave, and we aim to misbehave because that is the opportunity that has been, it's opportunistic rather than dedicated. So
worth pointing out that Star Wars has the most incompetently operated NECA in all of science fiction.
That's true. I had never thought about that, but that's totally true.
We have time for one more question, and if no one new has one, then I guess we'll take yours.
Yes.
Okay. It
had better be a good one.
Think about this carefully.
Two things for previous. One was Magic Knight's Rare. Go and find it in a secret chamber. Two, bring down the powers of a god into the body of a human. Voodoo.
Right.
And three, you talk about a mystical, these things having a mystical soul and judging it, but in case of a technological robot, it can have an AI system.
Right.
In which case, there's nothing mystical about it.
No.
It's a person, but it's a person made of platinum and optronics rather than proteins.
Yeah.
And it can judge you because it has its own personality and its own soul.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, though, in a lot of anime, that the AI may be, like, quote-unquote scientifically explainable, but there's always that line at which the AI reaches that point where it starts to become almost mystical.
Well,
to the degree...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, where
the
we think these lines...
The hand comes up and protection G.
Exactly. These lines, we think that they already exist between what is a sort of scientifically explainable object and then the thing that just sort of breaks that wall and becomes something otherwise.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right to a degree, yeah.
I love that moment in Evangelion where, like, the arm of Unit 1 comes up to protect Shinji Shinji and Rei from falling rebar. And Misato has that line, like this line that says, "Was it moving to protect someone? Was it moving to protect him?" And actually, that's not a great Evangelion moment. You send that thing back to the shop to be fixed the moment that happens, because it's actually malfunctioning in that moment. They're not supposed to do that. They're not supposed to move on their own. There's supposed to be a pilot in there. And if you saw it randomly having almost like these kind of, you know, jerking around on its own, you would think, oh no, it's either being hacked or something is terribly wrong in this giant machine that we just built because it's moving independently. That's bad. and yet it's never addressed in the story.
That's interesting. In Evangelion, actually, the biggest robot is Rei, because she doesn't have really a body on her own, but she only has a soul, and she doesn't know if she has one. She doesn't feel human. And in the reboot, at one point, she looks at an aquarium and said, "I can't live. I'm like this fish. I can't live outside a certain environment."
Yeah.
And it's about finding her humanity. And basically, what they're saying is that the robots also human, and like their own personality too, and stuff.
And with that, I think we're going to draw to a close.
Yes. Sure.
Thank you, panelists. Thank you, audience.
Thanks.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Heart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
boss will be with you. Always.
End of line.